Welcome to the Passive House Podcast, brought to you by Passive House Accelerator, a catalyst for zero carbon building. For news, stories, and connections from all flavors of Passive House, check out the articles, videos, and more at passivehouseaccelerator.com. Sign up to receive regular updates about events, join the community forum, and of course, attend the weekly online Global Passive House Happy Hour. Now, here's this week's Passive House Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the Passive House Podcast. I'm Matthew Cutler-Welsh, coming to you from Auckland in New Zealand.
And I'm Zach Semke, coming to you from Seattle, Washington.
How's things in Seattle, Zach?
Things in Seattle, they're good. They're good. We're, it's spring. It's now, it's cloudy and cold and wet. But, you know, that's Seattle. So
We're pretty happy, excited. Lots of excitement the last couple of days here because it was announced that we will soon be able to go and visit Australia again. So, borders between Australia and New Zealand. There was even some tentative talk of the South Pacific Passive House Conference happening.
Oh man,
might be exciting. A bit of a long shot to get our Australian and New Zealand colleagues together, but there's a lot of. It's been all over the news the last couple of days, sort of reopening, at least regionally anyway.
That's super exciting. You know, my 8 and 10-year-old just started going back to school on Monday, which was super exciting. They go back, they're there for 2 hours and 45 minutes, and then they come home. But the feeling, I mean, we love our kids, but... The sort of lightness, sort of bubbly feeling that I had when the house was empty at 8 in the morning was
because what is exciting. That's like 9 months, right?
It's been a year.
It's been
It's been over a year.
So they basically missed a year of interacting with other kids and
pretty much
being in a classroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
it's been a long time.
That's a topic for a whole different category of podcast, except to say that there are a lot of people that have become a lot more conscious of where they've been spending their time. And I think a few of our guests have touched on that people becoming a bit more aware of the air they breathe and who else has been breathing it and how healthy our places are to be, not just our homes, but a lot to do with our homes during the day. I've certainly been surprised how badly our house performs in the middle of the day when I wasn't normally here, but got to see it in a few different variations of the diurnal cycle. All right, but let's get into today's topic. Before we do that, we got some people to thank for bringing us the Passive House Podcast.
Yes, absolutely. So our founding sponsors are 475 High Performance Building Supply, Backstinkwe Architects, Glavel Foam Glass Gravel, Minotaur All-in-One HVAC and Dehumidification, Mitsubishi Electric Train HVAC US, Partel, RDH Building Science, Stocorp, and Zola Windows. And our stakeholder partner is NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Resource Development Authority. And our sponsor of the week this week is Stocorp. So Stocorp is supporting this Passive House podcast episode, as well as the Construction Tech Tuesday and Happy Hour that will be happening this coming week. So thank you to Stocorp.
Always great. Sessions, those Tech Tuesdays, which happen on a Wednesday if you're like me in New Zealand or Australia. And the Happy Hour, couldn't endorse them any more, really. In fact, I was talking to a Passive House builder, in Perth, Western Australia, and I said, oh, how does that timing work out? And he said, oh, it's great because it's 7 o'clock in the morning for him for the Happy Hour. So while you guys are all drinking whiskey and beer, he's having his first cup of coffee for the morning.
That's perfect. Oh, that's great to hear. Yeah, that's fun.
Let's talk about Bev Craig.
Yeah, Bev, I'm so excited to be able to share this interview with Bev. She's been part of the Passivhaus community for years now. I first saw her on the conference circuit talking about the cool work that she's doing in Massachusetts. So she is a lead AP and manages the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center's low and moderate income programs. And those programs include the Passivhaus Design Challenge for Affordable Housing, the Affordable Clean Residential Energy Program, and the Triple Decker Design Challenge. And we'll be touching on the Passivhaus Design Challenge and the Triple Decker Challenge in our conversation. She's got a background in energy efficiency retrofits and renewables, and holds a BA from the University of Southern California, as well as a master's in public policy from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center is this accelerator, to use the accelerator term, of innovation around energy in Massachusetts. And was we were just looking it up before the show started back in 2009. And it has its funding comes from a very small service charge on utility bills. So it's pretty cool to see the result and the work that Bev is able to do with that base of funding from Massachusetts ratepayers. So it's a really, really interesting conversation about the impact and potential for policymaking on Passivhaus uptake. And I think it has lessons for folks from, you know, across North America and around the world. So please enjoy. Thank you, Bev, for doing this podcast interview. I'm really excited about this. I'm also have been very fortunate to be working with you and planning this policy summit that we're going to be doing at the end of April. And so it's great to sit down with you. I was hoping that we could start by just taking a step back for listeners to the Passivhaus podcast who are probably more focused or maybe more focused on practice and on projects than they are on policy. Why is policy important to Passivhaus? Why should we care?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on, Zach. It's really a huge honor. And obviously, the individual projects and the practice are super important. But we have to sit back and think, like, if I do this project, even if it's a big one, like 8 buildings, 800 units, they're all passive, like that is such a huge achievement. But is it really going to make a dent in the climate trajectory we're on right now? It's not just in and of itself, but if we can scale up and create a tipping point, then we can really make a change. And policy is super important to changing from those individual projects to really getting it across the board. So really important to have the right framework of regulations, pricing, code. And especially when we get into retrofits, I think we really need the right policy framework, or things just won't happen through goodwill and good intentions and great practice. It's just, it won't scale up.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that you're also touching on this relationship between proof of concept that happens through projects, but then leveraging these examples to make real kind of market-wide change through policy. Like there's a relationship, a two-way relationship there, I guess, between project progress and policy progress.
Yes, I agree. And I think it gets easier over time, right? The first one you do is hard, and then it gets easier and easier. And if you can translate those lessons into the policy, it can be even more powerful.
Right. And I think we'll probably get into this in the conversation, but there's also proof of concept with policy. So like the work that you and others are doing in Massachusetts is now being emulated in Connecticut and other places. So that's an exciting thing to see for sure. Maybe we could just take a moment. Could you describe your role at MassCEC a bit, just as a little bit of a background, and then I'd love to dive into the Passivhaus Design Challenge.
Sure, sure. I'm a senior project manager working on low and moderate income programs, working at the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center. And we are a quasi-governmental state agency. So we're actually funded through a very small systems benefit charge on electricity in Massachusetts. And it's sort of our goal to help with economic development around clean energy and the clean energy economy in Massachusetts. So, you know, I would say we're really good innovators. So offshore wind, we own a blade testing facility for when offshore wind is built. Those blades will get tested, and the New Bedford Marine Terminal. You know, we're good at doing pilot projects that help our bigger Mass Save program implement things, especially in the low income program. So we're good at trying things out. And workforce, I think we're probably the most well-known in Massachusetts for our internship program, where we've paid for over 4,000 college interns to work at clean energy and efficiency firms across the state. So yeah, we like that innovation space.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and a key piece, a kind of crossover between what you just described and the Passive House world has been the Passive House Design Challenge. So tell us about the challenge and what, you know, how did you put that together? How was the program itself designed, and what have been some of the main takeaways as you've seen it implemented out in the world?
Sure. I come from a background of affordable housing. I've been working in Massachusetts on mostly retrofits, but also lead new construction for a number of years. And then I took this job 3 years ago, and we've been seeing so much progress in Pennsylvania in the low-income housing tax credit affordable world, where Tim McDonald and the folks in Pennsylvania were basically affordable projects that came in with passive designs were much more competitive for funding rounds, which meant they got funded faster. So I think there's something like, you know, 23 had been funded multifamily projects affordable in Pennsylvania, and the early cost data was showing it wasn't, you know, they didn't give them extra money, so they somehow had to bring it in with the same amount of money. And we were hearing similar sort of testimonials from New York City developers that it wasn't really that expensive. And so when I came to this position, we thought, hey, let's try and do that here in Massachusetts through the tax credit program. And we really just couldn't get any traction. And I think there was a real concern that it would be so expensive, like 10%, 15% more expensive. And just this, that it was going to be off the charts. And of course, there's always a tension in affordable housing, because if it's more expensive upfront, even if it saves money over the long term, it does limit how many new units they can put in, right? They can only fund so much upfront. So there was this tension. And we said, well, what can we do, again, in this innovation space? Can we just fund some projects? Let's try it out. Let's see if it really is that expensive. Let's get some teams getting some experience. And so in 2017, we launched a $1.7 million grant program for affordable projects going in for low-income housing tax credits to design to passive standards. We were subsidizing at $4,000 per unit. And so we were able to fund 540 units, 8 different projects. And we really cut it into pieces. So some pre-development money in affordable housing, you could almost never get pre-development money. So to have like one set of funds for that of the 4,000, and then some money at pre-certification, and then finally when it's built, the full 4,000. So, and one of those is built, Cambridge Finch, which last year won the Passive House, the FIAS Best Project and Best Affordable Project. It's a beautiful project, 98 units. And there's one that's just about finished in Gloucester, our smallest one, 30 units. 5 others under construction, and the one that's closed on the financing but hasn't broken ground yet. So far we're seeing very modest costs. I mean, we're lucky that I think Massachusetts stretch code is fairly advanced. So bumping it up, especially affordable housing, I think, has tended to lead on green building in the state. And so maybe it's not as much of a shift to go all the way to passive from where they were going before. But so far, incremental costs have been between 1.4% and 2.8%, which
is great. Yeah.
On projects that size, like that's like a normal swing, right? Of a project that size. Yeah. So that's great.
Yeah, absolutely. We saw the Cambridge Finch project on one of the early Global Passive House Happy Hour presentations, and really, it is an amazing project. So, when you designed that incentive program, the design challenge, how did you handle the final piece of the portion of the incentive that went to the building once it was built? Did it need to be certified, or did it need to go through the full process essentially, but certification wasn't required? How did you handle that piece of it?
Yeah, the last 1,500 per unit, you do have to actually get certified. So in Finch's case, I think it was a 6-month delay between when it was occupied and when it was certified, with all the balancing and the paperwork and stuff. But we didn't have trouble with that one. Hopefully none of our 8 will have any trouble. But I think there are ways to deal with it. You know, I think if you're doing, you know, that's the nice thing about the passive protocol is you have so much construction verification along the way. You're going to have a sense if you're on target or not all the way through if you're doing it right. And that means it's built the way it's designed. And we all know people build better when folks are watching them and mm-hmm. testing to make sure it's done right. So that's one of the things I've always loved about passive as, you know, LEED is also great, but like, and some architects can pull in projects with similar energy performance if they really prioritize that, but you don't have the same in construction verification. And I think that just makes a huge difference to projects not being all over the place. You get very consistent. I think when we get all these projects measured, their performance, we're going to see a very tight band of performance, I think, which is very different than what you see in LEED or code built multifamily.
Yeah, that's such a strength of Passive House for sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that this is really interesting the way that you are taking that $4,000 incentive and kind of chunking it out, or great, you know, there are kind of these steps that the team needs to achieve to get to the full 4,000. And it seems to me that because one of the potential challenges of incentives that rely on certification at the end is that's a risk for the developer. So that the incentive, there's the potential for this kind of unexpected, I mean, it's not really a penalty because you're not getting the incentive that you expected to receive. So in that way, it's a penalty. So it's that there's this danger of having the carrot of the incentive be undermined by a stick, you know, at the end. So it seems like is part of what you're doing navigating that dynamic with this stepped approach?
Yes, absolutely. And we haven't really talked about the Mass Save program, but it tries to do that as well.
Oh, so, let's do.
Okay.
That's a great segue.
Okay, so 9 months after we launched our program, the Mass Save program, which has a lot more resources in the state, and it's through the utilities. And they've been lobbied very hard to create a passive house incentive, so it's not like they just followed us, but they took a very similar structure with funding up to $5,000 for passive house feasibility study at the beginning, which can be integrated into a normal design charrette, which is a really nice benefit. Then paying 75% of passive house modeling, up to $20,000 per building. And then if you actually certify, it's $3,000. And so they have these pieces as well. And then the nice thing is say you didn't quite get to passive, but you tried. So you get it pre-certified. Yeah. There are two like pieces. So you get 500 of the 3,000 at pre-certification. Mm-hmm. But if you go and you don't quite get there, you still get double the normal new construction incentive. So there's like this fallback, right, as well, which is even more so than our program. And it's nice that it helps de-risk the trying. I think for people who are doing it mm-hmm. the first time and don't really believe that they can get there, it helps mm-hmm. get rid of some of that risk.
Right, which is so important because the point of these incentives is to get new teams to dive in. So that makes so much sense. So what kind of uptake has there been with the Mass Save program?
So it's been, I mean, just groundbreaking. So we had one multifamily certified passive in the state 3 years ago, the Distillery, then this one Finch. So we only have two certified right now, but there are 106 buildings, over 8,000 units that have applied for the feasibility and modeling money.
Whoa.
So that's awesome. Is a sea change.
That is.
You're... So that's, yeah.
I obviously didn't do my due diligence with research before this conversation. I didn't realize that the numbers were that big. That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, they may not all certify, but yeah, at least done the passive house modeling, which, yeah. I mean, I don't think most architects think about thermal bridging much, right? So at least it's going to pull that out. And yep. I think things that are not that expensive that they can change, like mm-hmm. just to focus on the air infiltration rate might mm-hmm. get in there, even if they don't go to triple glazed windows, right? So right. I think it will make for much better performance of the ones that participate, even if they don't certify.
Yeah. And what is the lifetime? I mean, what's the duration of this program, the Mass Save incentive?
So it's a three, our utility programs run on a 3-year cycle. So we're 2 years in, so they'll definitely be there for another year. They're renewing this. And I think generally the utility sees this as one of the cheapest ways to get savings, honestly, because it's upfront. It's not trying to get new existing buildings. You don't have to advertise. Like the uptake's been great. Like they haven't seen a huge incremental cost. It's been easy to get people to do it. And I think it's easy to compare against code as well. So they can quantify the savings a lot better than they can on other categories of things they might try and spend the money on.
So, right.
Well, so I'm optimistic it'll be similar.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was one of the Pennsylvania example has been one that I have been banging a drum about for years, because it has been so exciting to see the cost data from that, and also the, you know, the uptake that Passive House had. But a couple of observations on that. One is that you're dwarfing those numbers in with this program in Massachusetts in terms of projects. And two, in Pennsylvania, unfortunately, PHFA kind of backtracked a little bit with the clarity that it was bringing to incentivizing Passive House. And so it's great to hear that it sounds like that knock on wood, that won't be the case with this after right. the 3 years. So,
and our examples are market rate and affordable. So it's not mm-hmm. just affordable. Mm-hmm. The Mass Save mm-hmm. program's for everybody. It doesn't matter what category. So it's nice to get it out in the market rate as well, because mm-hmm. if people have a good experience in the market rate, that could leverage a lot more. I think there's probably more building in the market rate anyway. So
yeah, yeah.
And I will say, so our tax credit agency did add 2 additional points over LEED and Enterprise in the last round. So we did convince them enough with these early projects that they did incorporate that in. And I know in the last round, I think 6 projects. So I think it was 3/4 of the new construction projects that were tax credit awards did go passive.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's yeah. good. So
yeah.
it's
yeah.
definitely helps when there's multiple policies pushing for it. Mm-hmm. In fact, actually there's another thing I didn't think about bringing this up, but in our state, larger projects that are multifamily have to go through an environmental impact statement process. And so the state Department of Energy Resources reviews those projects and suggests improvements. For about 2 or 3 years, the staff there have really been pushing Passive House too. So some of the bigger market rate ones might have been more interested in this Mass Save incentive because they were 2 agencies at the same time were telling them to go passive. So
yeah, yeah. That's cool to see that kind of amplification happening. And more recently, you've been involved in this triple decker challenge. And for folks who have lived in Boston, they'll know what a triple decker is. But what is a triple decker? And what was this challenge all about?
You know, our passive house work was really focused on new construction, but that's the easy part, right? In the climate buildings calculation. Mm-hmm. So I think in Massachusetts, about 27% of operational energy from buildings is part of our greenhouse gas emissions. So it's really right after transportation, it's the next biggest major slice of the pie chart, right? So, and we know about 80% of the buildings here today are going to be around in 2050. So we got to focus on retrofits, right? And, you know, there's all this amazing energy sprung stuff going on, Retrofit New York. But we wanted to start with something people had a real emotional attachment to. And if you've lived in the Boston area, and actually I think even in New England in general, mm-hmm. a triple decker is basically three identical units stacked on top of each other in one building, usually a flat roof, almost always wood framed. They were often built over 100 years ago, and they were pretty much immigrant factory worker housing. And it was really common for a family to buy the whole thing. And they'd live on one floor and their cousins would live on another floor and they'd rent out another floor. And, you know, they've sort of been handed down in those families too. So I would say it's very much what we would tend to call naturally occurring affordable housing. So it's not subsidized directly, but it tends to be lower rents and maybe not as well maintained too. And they tend to have pretty horrible energy performance is the other thing. I think we did assess too as part of this challenge, and the HERS ratings were like off the charts. Over 200. Wow. And the air infiltration was like 23 ACH 50 on average. So it's like really uncomfortable in these places, right? And pretty much no insulation if it's 100 years old and it's never been insulated, right? So, and this is a pretty common building type in Massachusetts. So I think Boston area has at least 9,000. New Bedford has at least 4,000. Worcester has a ton. Like our gateway communities, like Lowell, Lawrence have quite a few. So it's something that we could think about at least, you know, having a pattern book for it. Like, how do we,
right.
And the goal really of this challenge was to think forward. Let's assume the electric grid really does get to 100% renewable. How do we increase the efficiency and electrify this common building type? And so we put out $150,000 of prizes with some support from the Barr Foundation, really generous local foundation here, and asked designers and design build firms and anybody who wanted to, and even students, we got one student application, to come up with a new way of retrofitting these, what they would do and actually design it and cost it. Because we didn't have a lot of cost info. And so that was one of the things we thought would be really important. And we sort of had two tracks. So we had this concept that some of these might be able to add a unit in the backyard or to the side or maybe even a fourth floor with the right zoning framework to add this sort of gentle density, right? And hopefully that extra value might be able to cross subsidize the retrofit of the rest of the building. So we had one path that was just, you know, you keep the existing square footage and then one that you added units. And so we got 13 proposals. We announced just about a month ago the winners. You can always just, if you Google Mass CEC triple decker design, you'll see all of them. They did a lot of like really cool, like 3-minute videos. And I think you guys are going to be putting it in your Retrofit magazine, right? Retrofit Summit magazine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So yeah, lots of great ideas. And then our board just recently, with some funding also from the Department of Energy Resources, is going to try and test out some of these, both for the costs and the approaches that were suggested. So we think we're going to be able to fund about 10 that are subsidized affordable housing triple deckers and 10 that are market rate and nice. Sort of test out things. So, and hopefully that will scale up into something bigger. Eventually.
Yeah. That's so important. Obviously the retrofit piece is incredibly vital to our all sorts of goals, but climate goals for sure. So were there some like early learnings from these projects, some trends that you saw or approaches that you suspect will be, you know, particularly sort of powerful or insightful, or what, where, or is it, or do you think we need to wait and see once the 10 projects of each are built?
I think before the 10 projects of each category are built, we are going to pull together a white paper with summary. And we're also talking about having like a series every quarter. Like people are very interested in this and have lots of actually field experience. So we want to keep collecting that. But there are a couple things. One is, you know, these buildings are starting at such a horrible starting point that it's not hard to do what is a technical deep energy retrofit with not that expensive measures, right? Right. Like, you know, just dense packing the walls and putting on a really good roof and doing the right thing in the basement. You can do a deep energy retrofit, not that expensive. So that's good. I think one thing we are concerned about from the applications we saw, well, first of all, I think the applications were a little bit Tesla-ish, and we need to have Chevy Bolts to make this an offering statewide. So we have to figure out how to do this all a little bit less expensively, or doing replacing parts as they need to be replaced. So does the is the siding in such bad shape that we might as well take it off and put continuous, you know, a good air barrier and continuous insulation? Sure. But if it's still got a good 15 years in it, is this the right time? Can we get there just by focusing on the roof? But I do think the roof, so balloon framing, if you don't top off, even if you dense pack it, if you just put exterior continuous on top, whether it's wood fiber or polyiso or whatever, and you have this air infiltration from the balloon framing, if you don't stop that air infiltration, it's just like an island of insulation. It's not very effective, right? So I do think we need to think about how to do roofs right. Because that's probably the biggest divergent from what actually happens in real practice. Like with a flat roof, when the membrane's about to go and you're going to replace it, you just replace the membrane. You don't change any insulation. You don't add any, you know, air tightness. So that's like the biggest thing that I see as a divergence from real life, what happens over time. So I do think the roof's pretty important. And that's almost like a workforce thing, right? No roofer, every roofer wants to take off the roof and get the new one on as fast as possible. They're not going to wait around for air sealing teams from above, right? So like, how do we integrate that into a kind of company that specializes in this? And then it's probably got to be both an incentive and a stick, right? So you've got to have municipalities say, no, you can't just replace the membrane with like membrane. You have to do it right. And maybe we need to make, you know, 0% loans for that kind of work so that everybody can do it right.
Yeah. You're getting at a little bit of the, and maybe we'll touch on this a little bit later in the conversation, but the relationship, we talk about the three legs of policy progress, right, for the summit that we're planning, with the incentives and regulation, a couple, like there's raising the floor through code, and then also setting a cap through emissions caps like Local Law 97. And it sounds like there's some percolating stuff happening in Boston and Cambridge, but that the realization that there are, that the different legs of the stool kind of can support one another, not to belabor the metaphor. And this, so that this idea of, you know, mandating a certain, you know, that you're going to have to do more, but supporting that with a loan program, you know, with some sort of incentive is kind of an important one too in success with change through policy.
Yeah. And we haven't done these yet. Like, I don't know if my initial thoughts are right. Like we have to test it out in the field, beta test it. Right. So that'll be exciting to try that out. So.
Yeah, cool. So I know there's been some really big climate news in Massachusetts over the last week, and you shared a great article in WBUR that I enjoyed reading. And tell us about what's happening and what the implications are for your work at MassCEC and just more broadly.
Yeah, it's so exciting. So last Friday, Governor Baker signed our climate law. And I think the biggest thing is basically everybody in the state now has the same goal of net zero by 2050. So even the Department of Public Utilities, our utility programs, like everybody has to be focused on that. And that's really going to mean a different approach to fossil fuels in general on buildings, I think. And it is, so to get to that, it's a really ambitious goal. It's a really ambitious goal. And I think what that means for MassCEC is we're going to have to get even more innovative. We need to figure out how to way to do it equitably and affordably. And that's the real challenge. So we need to make existing buildings more efficient, and we need to make new construction very good so that we don't have to go retrofit it in 10 years, right? So both of those, the buildings part is, and especially the existing buildings, is the toughest nut to crack. And we can definitely be innovators in this space. So we're excited about that. And definitely optimistic that we're going to have a lot of new interesting stuff. And if you thought we were sort of ahead of the game before, I think you're going to see even more of that in the next decade. So
yeah. From my place in Seattle, Washington, reading through that, and we've had some good progressive change in climate, but reading through the different elements of the, I don't know if it's called the Climate Act or what it's called. I don't remember, but I was salivating. I mean, it was just like, there's just so much great stuff. And you're right that it looks like with the stretch code thing, you know, work that's already happened in Massachusetts, and the fact that will then, you know, it sounds like it'll be easier for local jurisdictions to adopt a stretch code that's moving toward net zero buildings, right?
Definitely high performance buildings. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I think there'll be different flavors. We'll see, but yeah, it's great.
Really, so there's this clear mechanism for new construction and the retro. So then the question is, how do you make the retro happen?
Getting down to this, not certainly, you know, I've run in the low income world for a long time, and our MassSafe program is fantastic and has done really good job across the board doing shallow work, but we can't really do that here out. Like, maybe we have to think about, so in low income, you know, the very complex financing, at least in the US that we have, makes it pretty much impossible to take on debt midstream. So you have to wait for this major refinance to happen. And I do think we may see that instead of doing shallower work across a lot of properties, that we need to invest deeper at those big refinance moments to get to the levels that we're going to need to get to net zero by 2050. So we'll see. I mean, it's a whole new landscape. Well, I have no idea how this is all going to translate, but it's really, really great step in the right direction.
Yeah, that's exciting. So one last question. So I've alluded a number of times to the fact that we're working on this policy summit. It'll be April 26th and super exciting. And one of the things I'm hoping that we can provide to participants at that summit is a set of ideas about how to help move the policy needle, like how can our community be engaged and help with progress in this area. So what advice do you have to share for the Passive House community in this regard?
So I think in the US, states that don't already have some kind of systems benefit charge, you should be looking into that. And I think the majority do, but that's like where energy efficiency money, like I'm talking about with MassSave, comes from. And without those kind of resources, unless we get like huge federal money, that's a really good place to start. And I think most utilities are familiar with the concept and how it works, and, you know, shifting their approach from just looking at, you know, payback within a certain period or avoiding a certain power plant that they have to build to greenhouse gases. That's another change. But at least if you have the money being collected, that gives you resources. So I would start with that. I think we have to, you know, a new green economy is going to take a lot of jobs. And I actually think retrofitting existing buildings and building new, really efficient buildings, that is a place where there's going to be a lot of job growth. So in the places where we can, you know, combine the economic development, job creation stuff with this, you know, high performance renovations and additions kind of stuff, that there's a nice nexus there. So like being able to couch it in those terms too can be helpful, especially, you know, it's going to be difficult at the federal level when big changes happen. So we have to find new jobs for people. And I think building trades, you know, we're having trouble recruiting people, honestly, for building trades, and they can be really good jobs. And same thing with heat pumps, which is going to have a huge future, right? So the more we can focus on the job creation side and actually pairing programs and projects to bring more people into this kind of inclusive economy, the better off we're going to be.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Well, thank you. Is there anything else that you want to share before we close?
Well, I just want to say thank you. I can't believe it's been over a year since we got locked down. You guys like were up and running right away, like keeping us busy every week. And between the hosts and your work, I mean, I just so look forward to the happy hours all the time. And you just have put so much content out, and there is so much great community. I just want to give you a big thanks, because when I get thrown into one of those breakout rooms with somebody from, you know, I'll talk to a structural engineer in Australia about embodied carbon, and awesome. Somebody in New York that I should have been talking to, and somebody in, you know, Vancouver. It's just, it's really great. Like, I would have never crossed paths if this hadn't, you know, happened. It's one of the nice upsides of what we've been going through in the last year.
Yeah, it's been really fun, hasn't it? I mean, not this last year, but this community, it's a great group. It's so much fun. So thank you. And thanks for being part of it. And thanks for leading the way in so many ways in Massachusetts. It's really heartening and exciting work. So it's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me. This has been great. And kudos. I know it's been a lot of work.
It's awesome. It's so fun. Thanks. All right. So that was Beverly Craig with a great interview and lots of insights around policy and Passive House. Matthew, what were your thoughts?
So I'm really excited about this topic, talking about policy. I was a little bit, I guess, cautious, unexcited about it, because I think to a lot of people, policy seems like a bit of a dry topic, something we try and avoid. But this is just evidence of how important it is and how it can drive change. And one of the last points from this was just hearing that excitement from Beverly about the stuff that she's doing. And it's real potential to drive change. I mean, kudos to you for not doing any background research before you. Because
thank you.
I love the reaction to her
the numbers
yeah. of going from one, the first project just 3 years ago, to over 100 projects. You know, imagine if every municipality, every city had that sort of uptake and kept on going. It wouldn't take that long to really bed in Passive House design to a lot of projects that we're doing. I mean, that's just an incredible influence that her and her team are having.
It really is. You know, you shared the hesitancy around policy, and Michael Ingwe, you know, my colleague, collaborator, and founder, the accelerator, shares that, and I totally get it. But I have felt like policy is sexy since like the 90s when I first got out of school. So I'm always reminded that that's not necessarily the case for most people. But I think that when you see those kinds of results, you know, it that's how can you not be excited about that, right?
Yeah.
And I think that for a lot of people in the policy, in the Passive House world, perhaps the Brussels story and the transformational change the policy had in Brussels leading up to Passive House becoming code in 2015, maybe that was the first kind of entree. But yeah, to be able to have that kind of impact, and I think it also, I mean, it speaks to Bev's and her team's creativity to leverage limited resources, to really make big moves.
That's a really good word for it. And the types of funding mechanisms that Beverly was talking about were familiar to me here, as I think they might be to a people around the world, because she was talking about her own city, and a lot of these policies are going to be very specific to a small geographic region, but the concepts are totally transferable and have been applied in a lot of other places. And so, stepping back, what I've seen in parts of New Zealand in the past, and I know it happens in Australia, is you have these utility companies that take a tiny fraction from utility bills, electricity bills, or something from a large number of people over a period of time, and it adds up to a substantial amount of money. They're not necessarily funding whole projects. They're not building buildings, not paying consultants, but they might just be providing a few thousand dollars here or there for modeling, for example, which then takes that financial pain away from the building owner who may have never heard of PHPP or Passive House or something. They don't, and you don't have to sell it to them then, because it just, it can get taken care of over here quietly, get paid for. But the implications of just having that financial pain taken away are huge, because it can completely alter the direction of that project. So the key message there is, I think that it's all well and good. It's easy to sort of look at these examples and say, oh, well, that's fine, they've got money. And my message is, have a look where the money is, because there's probably similar pots of money where you are. It's just a matter of finding out what your equivalent of the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center is.
Right. And also, how can we advocate to make sure that there are where we may need more incentive money or requirements in the form of code, or I'm thinking of the three-legged stool of policy that we're going to be sharing at the policy summit. So incentives/ subsidies, raising the floor through code, and emissions caps. So setting the limit. I think that part of the story that I think she's sharing is that we can, and this is true also for the Massachusetts climate legislation that just got passed, is that we as people and citizens, or advocates, can impact that, and can help create pots of money or policy. And I think that one of the things that is particularly cool about Passive House is that it eliminates the performance gap. And so the thing that's great about that is that then policymakers can be, once they're educated, can be assured that when they're doing a policy that's centered around Passive House, that they know that they're going to get the result they want, which is lower energy bills for low-income people, or operational carbon emissions reductions. They know that those are really going to happen, as opposed to other forms of green building, which I won't necessarily name, that have had this problem with the performance gap, right? So,
well, Bev mentioned that, that she explicitly said that the verification is a missing part of some green building type certifications.
Right.
Whereas,
right.
You stick a blower door on a passive house, you quantify how it performs.
Right. Exactly. And so the policymakers can have that certainty. The building developers can have that certainty, because they know that they can also be assured that they're going to get what's advertised at the end of the day. And so you can build incentive programs that are really carrots, and don't have a scary stick at the end of the road that says, come back to us a year after you've occupied the building and show us your energy data. And if you don't make the numbers, you're going to get whacked by the stick. With Passive House, they know that on average, they're going to get a good result. So there's a lot of opportunity there, I think, therefore, for effective policy advocacy.
And I'm not sure, I haven't delved into the charter or the constitution of Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, but a lot of these entities, these quasi-government agencies, have a mandate, either because they're there to offset the fact that a lot of utility companies, for example, are monopolies, so they generate this money, they have to do something with it back to the community. So they often have some obligation to fund something. The other people might be skeptical and say, why would a utility company be interested in saving energy? Surely their business model is selling more. But what often happens, particularly with aging infrastructure, is that it's in their interests to keep the demand kind of where it is, because if their whole infrastructure is built on a steady demand of energy, And if that increases, or we get a really hot day, a really cold day, they get this big spike, and they have to be able to cope with those peaks. And that means that they have to build really, really expensive infrastructure that doesn't get used most of the time. So if they could, it's in their interest to keep the energy demand as flatline and as steady as possible. That's why things like Passive House are really, really beneficial to these utilities companies whose business model is selling energy, but they like to sell it at a very nice constant level throughout the year, which is exactly what a passive house does, whatever size building. So that's where the connection is, and that's why it makes sense for someone who's selling energy to help buildings not just use less of it, but use it in a more consistent way. So I just wanted to put that out there to reduce any skepticism, again, that this type of pot of money may actually be available in places that you might not have thought of.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also points to the fact that, you know, that more kind of flat demand curve that Passive House brings to the table, both on a daily basis and on a seasonal basis, is also really helpful for integration of renewables into the mix.
Yeah. So, which is much harder to build for if we're dealing with lots of peaks and troughs.
Right.
Lots of awesome stuff in there. My final point is that another one we've talked about quite a lot in the past is her emphasis on the challenge, but also the opportunity of retrofits, and saying that doing new builds, that's the easy stuff. It's the, what did she say, 80% of today's buildings will be the ones that are still around in 2050. And those 2050 plans that we're all making are these awesome targets, that's less than 30 years away now. So we really need to start thinking about that, because we are looking at the building stock that exists that's going to be contributing to that energy demand when those debts come due.
Yeah, right, exactly. And the energies and the building stock being a lot of triple deckers.
Yes.
Which I've anybody who's lived in New England probably knows them. I lived in one for 3 years. And yeah. they're you know, they have some charm, but yeah, their performance is pretty poor.
So yeah, there's of those types, but there's going to be demand for increasing urban density as well. So I think we're going to see a more modern form of the triple decker or walk ups or whatever they mm-hmm. Medium density building. That's going to increase.
Yeah, I think so too. And the fact that they are performing so poorly now, I mean, she alludes to the fact that there means there's a lot of opportunity to make big progress on energy efficiency gains an affordable way. So yeah, that's definitely that whole challenge is I think something for all of us to keep our tabs on, and as those projects actually get built and we see some cool lessons learned from them.
Now, you mentioned the policy summit, which is partly why we're having this conversation here today with Beverly, and we're having a bit of a policy theme for the month of April. What have we got leading up to the policy summit? And give people just a reminder about what the policy summit is.
Yeah, thank you. The policy summit is on Monday, April 26th. So that'll be Tuesday, April 27th, your time in New Zealand and Australia. It'll be 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. And we're going to dive into examples from New York State, from Massachusetts, from Connecticut, from British Columbia, and from Washington State. I'm probably leaving out some, and looking at that both shining examples of incentives or code progress or emissions caps, as well as more scrappy examples of progress in those areas. So for example, the work that Mike Fowler has done in the state of Washington to kind of in a stealth way sort of sneak in a lot of elements of Passive House into elements of the new building energy code without necessarily labeling them as such. So yeah, I think the purpose of the summit is to is to essentially share proof of concept and great examples across that we as practitioners slash advocates can then help move in our own communities. So the BC STEP Code is a great example of a shining example of how to raise the floor in a predictable way for the industry toward passive house, and has lessons for throughout the states. And I imagine there's some good lessons for New Zealand. So it's going to be a really fun conversation with a group of really smart people. So I'm looking forward to learning from them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great opportunity. And of course, we've got a regular diary calendar of content coming up as well.
We do, yeah. So this coming week, we have a Construction Tech Tuesday, Wednesday for you in New Zealand and Australia, appearance by Nikki Kruger and Trey Farmer. And they are going to be talking about mechanical system design in hot and humid climates. So they're based in Austin. Trey was just featured in an article about the deep freeze that happened in Austin and the experience of passive survivability in his passive house. So that'll be a great program. And then we have on Wednesday a visit by Oliver Style, who will be talking about retrofit, air tightness, and moisture control. So as we're retrofitting these buildings, we need to be thinking about how the building science is working and how these control layers work. So we'll dive into that. And then I have a lot of links to educational programming by Passive House organizations around the world that I'll share in the show notes.
Awesome. And we'll put some links up to some of the things that we talk about in this episode, like the triple decker design competition and some of those policies and projects that yep. That Bev was talking about as well. So you can check that out over at the Passive House Accelerator website, passivehouseaccelerator.com. And there's a big button there that says Passive House Podcast. So you can check that out. All right. I think that does it for us for this week, Zach.
Yeah. Thank you, Matthew. That was great.
Thank you very much. We'll be back again next week on Passive House Podcast.